In the wake of Katrina, 45 people were found dead at New Orleans Memorial Hospital. Sherry Fink, the author of 5 Days at Memorial, is here to tell us what happened.
Because any of us could face a disaster in the future, and just the very fact that people thought that this happened suggested that something went very wrong.
Why is the caring for a dying parent or spouse so difficult, so painful, and so insanely expensive? Katie Butler will talk about her new book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death.
She taught me that you can face your death with realism and courage and clean up the ends of your life and really die quite prepared.
Also examining life and death issues, The Cancer Chronicles. Author George Johnson joins us to talk about the mysterious science behind the disease.
These are adaptations, and it's becoming fitter and fitter. But fitness for the tumor means that it's thriving at the expense of the rest of the body.
That all sounds grim, but this week also marks the relaunch and redesign of the book review, and my colleague Jen McDonald will be here to talk about what readers can expect. Julie Bosman has notes from the field, and Greg Coles joins us with bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Sherry Fink, who won a Pulitzer Prize for the New York Times with her 2009 article in the magazine about Memorial Hospital in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, joins us to talk about her new book, 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Pamela.
So this is a story you've obviously been tracking for a long time. When did you become interested in this? Were you down reporting directly after Katrina?
I was down with a public health team after Katrina, working in some of the shelters and looking at what the medical needs were in a mass crisis where everybody was displaced. But I started hearing about these awful situations in the hospitals. But I think I mostly heard about the story the way that a lot of people did, which is when these three health professionals, a doctor and two nurses, were arrested and accused of having murdered their patients. I had been a medical aid worker in a number of crises.
You're a doctor.
By training, yes.
In addition to
turned reporter. But for a few years, I did aid work, and I had written a book about the genocide in Bosnia, about a hospital there, but I'd never heard of any allegations like this outside of the realm of fiction. And so I figured whatever happened there would have some important lessons for us, because any of us could face a disaster in the future. And just the very fact that people thought that this happened suggested that something went very wrong. So I wanted to learn more.
And your first book, War Hospital, was kind of a year in the life or the existence of a hospital during wartime. And this book also takes place at a hospital, but it's a very different kind of book. How did you approach it in terms of talking about the hospital? You have the Hurricane Katrina, and then you obviously have this case, and then all of the ethical, medical, political issues that it raises. That's a lot to weave together, I imagine.
I think what is at the heart of it is this question of whether crisis is a time where we should hold tighter than ever to our moral values, or whether it's a time when exceptional times call for changes in moral values. And that sort of like undergirds the whole book, plus these questions that go back to the time of Aristotle, which is like, who gets the goods of society when they're scarce? And in this case, you have the first half of the book where it's just a day by day. You go from a normal functioning hospital in New Orleans, in this city, the floodwaters rise after the storm hits. It gets hot in the hospital. The backup power, like in many American hospitals, doesn't make the air conditioning function. It's a vulnerability a lot of us have. And then also, like a lot of American hospitals in flood zones, believe it or not, as we saw in New York, elements of the backup power system were below flood level. So that first half of the book, you just walk through the power's about to fail. This ethical dilemma arises. Who do you rescue first when the helicopters start coming? There's 245 patients. There's 2,000 people. Helicopters are taking one or two people at a time. You know that within hours, all of your power is going to fail as the floodwaters rise. And so that's the scenario of the first half. And then the second half is looking at a second dilemma, which is not triage, which is, you know, those difficult decisions about who do you rescue first, the baby, the elderly person, the sickest, the healthiest, the healthcare workers themselves who are getting, you know, starting to have health problems, who will be needed as the city recovers. And then the second half looks at this allegation that in those very desperate days when they decided, in fact, to keep some of the sickest people for last, that possibly 20 people had been injected with these drugs to hasten their deaths. And so how do we deal as a society with something that would on its face be a massive crime, like a mass murder, but in these circumstances of utter confusion and desperation? And so it looks at how our justice system kind of dealt with that and how larger society in New Orleans dealt with those questions.
Tell us about the doctor at the center of the case.
Dr. Anna Poe was the doctor who was arrested, and she was arrested on allegations of second-degree murder in the cases of four of those patients who I mentioned.
And why was it these four? There were 45 bodies discovered dead in the wake of Katrina at Memorial. What happened with these four bodies that made them different from the others?
It really wasn't that they were different. It was more that as the prosecutors put together their case, they found the strongest evidence first for these four. They were the first four toxicology results to come back to show that they had these drugs in their body.
What were the drugs?
Morphine and a drug called Versed. That's its brand name, which is like a fast-acting, very powerful sedative that you really only see in certain circumstances, not the kind of thing you normally give people to sedate them.
So this was the charge was essentially that she had euthanized these
exactly.
patients.
Yeah, although the attorney general said, this isn't euthanasia, this is murder. Of course, it's sort of the same under the law there. But
it's in many ways a story in which the law with these very black and white definitions comes up against the ethical medical issues.
And this was a doctor, as is pointed out in the review, who, you know, comes as close as possible as anyone could imagine to the kind of doctor you'd want, who gives you her cell phone number, who works so hard she has almost nothing else in her life. This person who you would be the last person you'd expect to do something like this.
So tell us about her. She was 51 years old. How long had she been in Memorial? Was she a New Orleans native? What was her background?
She was a New Orleans native, the Uptown group. Her father had been a doctor. She came from a large Catholic family, was a very faithful woman. And she had moved away. When you train in her field, she was a head and neck surgeon who specialized in the hardest part of head and neck surgery. She'd been all over the country for her training and had just come home to be near her mother, who was a new widow. And so she'd only been at this hospital for about a year.
And let's talk about the hospital. Is this a public hospital? What section of New Orleans was it in? And how typical was it of other hospitals during Katrina at the time?
It was just a kind of a regular community hospital, served a wide clientele. It had been a faith-based hospital. It was Southern Baptist. And then the book kind of traces this whole change in the whole kind of our healthcare system with the where large corporations end up buying up these community hospitals. And this was now a tenant-owned hospital, which is a large hospital corporation that was at the time based in Texas.
What happened with the court case?
For a year, her life was really in limbo. She was arrested, not kept in jail or anything like that, let out on a bond. And the two nurses who were arrested with her, the district attorney who was in charge of prosecuting, he gave them immunity and forced them to testify at a grand jury, which you need to pursue charges of murder in Louisiana. You need a grand jury to indict. So he focused in on Anna Poe, but he was really conflicted himself. He had a good friend who was a policeman who had been sort of in an analogous case, had been accused along with other police of having shot unarmed civilians. And it was a very serious case. And in fact, the feds took it up later. But this, I guess the defense of those police for doing this horrific act was that they had acted in chaos. So it was sort of an analogous debate going on about should these people go to jail for what they did, that in normal times would be horrific, but with the context of the disaster. So this prosecutor himself was very conflicted. And so what he decided to do is something very unusual, which is to go to the grand jury and tell them, you be the investigators. And so they were in charge of deciding to some extent what evidence they would hear. Well, they decided in the end not to indict her.
Did you talk to the jury members? Did you talk to people who were involved in the court case and to the prosecutor and to the lawyers on all sides?
Yeah, actually, I did. I did. I think I talked to people in all of those categories.
And I'm assuming to Dr. Anna Poe as well.
I did speak with Dr. Poe. She did not discuss the events that are at the heart of the story, however. As I sat down for my interview, I was told that we had to skip Thursday, September 1st, 2005, which was the day that the alleged events occurred. And at that time, she was facing, it was after the grand jury, but she faced some civil suits. So she did not want to address those.
Is she still facing those suits?
No, they've settled now. But she still hasn't ever, as far as I can tell, and all the lectures that she's given, she hasn't ever really addressed, except to say that she was innocent.
Obviously, there's so many complicated ethical questions raised, and you look at this from so many different perspectives. But how did you, in the end, come down on the central question of the case and the verdict that the court arrived at?
What I came away with is just, well, there's a quote from this book, Blindness, that is something about yesterday we could see, today we can't, and tomorrow we will see again. And it's just, when we're in the midst of a disaster, it's sometimes hard to see the tomorrow. These actions, I don't think anybody would think it's a good thing that doctors and nurses felt that they had to inject patients with these drugs and that these patients died, some of whom probably would not have died. That's not a good thing. So the question is, how do we prevent that in the future? And how do we, if we're faced with disasters and we're in a situation where the corporation isn't helping and the government isn't arriving fast enough. And this happens over and over again in every disaster that I've worked in, every conflict zone. It all comes down to our own individual actions and decision-making and our own personal preparedness. And I think by understanding this story, it can change how we would act and the way that we look at the importance of our own values and the values of the people around us. Because what this case did was really destroy trust between the family members of these patients and the community and the medical profession. And we need a wider discussion about these questions of what we do when there's not enough resources to go around. That's my hope.
Sherry, thank you so much. It's obviously a very relevant issue, and it looks like a fascinating and important book. So thank you.
Thank you.
The book is 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital by Sherry Fink.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Salinger, the biography of one of the most beloved and mysterious 20th century authors. That's Salinger, written by David Shields and Shane Salerno, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman joins us with Notes from the Field. What's going on out there, Julie?
Well, this week we had a major step forward in picture book ebook adoption. The Dr. Seuss Estate and Random House Children's Books, which is the primary English language publisher of Dr. Seuss's books, said that they were going to make available Dr. Seuss's books in ebook format for the first time.
And this is a lot of the classics, many of the I Can Read books, the Green Eggs and Ham,
The Cat in the Hat, there's a Walk It in my pocket, The Lorax. I think this is a victory for The Lorax, actually, since
now that it's
papers.
Yet another format.
Yeah, so there's certainly plenty of Dr. Seuss books in the marketplace beyond the print books, movies, apps, TV shows, and apparently Dr. Seuss himself was always looking for opportunities to convert his books into other properties.
But he was a very smart man, right? Because he held on to the digital rights to his books.
Very smart. He died in 1991 at the age of 87. We would think that perhaps book contracts were not written with provisions that allowed for ebooks at this time, but they did. They didn't refer specifically to ebooks in most cases, but they referred to the digital rights of a book. I think publishers were probably thinking more about CD-ROMs, which, believe it or not, were once a scary thing in the publishing industry.
Now contracts say, you know, into the universe and beyond. They just cover the whole gamut. So what happened that spurred this change?
Barbara Marcus, who's the president and publisher of Random House Children's Books, stepped into her new job about a year ago, and she told me that one of the first things that she wanted to do was really ratchet up the whole line of Dr. Seuss books.
And Barbara Marcus comes from Scholastic and is obviously very used to dealing with these big franchise authors.
Yes, she came from Scholastic. After Scholastic, she was working as a consultant, working for Open Road, which is the digital publisher run by Jane Friedman. So she has a lot of experience with this. And in her view, there was a lot more that could have been done with the Dr. Seuss books. And one obvious thing for anyone who works in the industry right now is to convert those books into ebooks. So that was something that she really wanted to do. But it also took the cooperation of Dr. Seuss Enterprises, which is the organization that controls the Dr. Seuss brand. And his widow is actually still alive, and she's very much involved as the custodian of his estate.
There's an idea that there's a huge market for e-picture books out there that just hasn't been tapped because parents and teachers and others who make these book buying decisions aren't really buying into e-books as much as other genres.
That's right. It's been very, very slow in terms of ebook adoption. When you compare it to, say, adult trade fiction, many, many novels that are for sale right now will sell more copies in ebook than in print. This is especially true in genre fiction. The more commercial the fiction is, the more that it will sell in ebooks. This has not been true in picture books for a lot of different reasons. One reason is, like you said, parents haven't really been sold on the idea. I think it took a while for the technology to really catch up. You have a beautiful copy of The Cat in the Hat in print, and you know the illustrations are gorgeous. It looks a very certain way. It's very difficult to get that looking perfect in digital form. It's certainly a lot easier to just convert, you know, a text file of 50 Shades of Grey into an ebook. So I think that there were technologically there were challenges, but it was also a matter of publishers making them available. The authors really had to be satisfied with the way that the books looked. And there's also the major issue that people buy picture books in a very different way than the way that they buy, say, a novel. They want to go to a bookstore. They want to flip through it. You can easily see what you're about to buy when you have a picture book. And there's also a huge gift market for picture books. So you can't just hand someone an iTunes gift card, and it doesn't really have the same effect as a picture book.
And I think picture books are such a memento of childhood. Dwight Garner did that beautiful piece recently about finally letting go of his children's picture books now that his kids are well into their novel reading years. I certainly have enjoyed the idea or the process of having one of my children sit on my lap and memorize Fox and Socks and learn to flip the pages and read it the old-fashioned way.
And I think for a lot of parents who spend their days glued to one screen or another, they really don't want to have that end of the day read with your child experience be on yet another screen. It's the one analog thing that we can possibly do. And as people have pointed out to me in the last 24 hours since this story came up, You know, there's a lot of reasons developmentally for a child to read a picture book in print versus the fine motor skills of turning the page, understanding the, you know, filling in the blanks and the things in a picture book that aren't completely obvious. It's very different than playing a game or using an app on an iPad.
It's hard enough to get your child to turn off the light at bedtime after story reading without having to press another button. Okay, well, Julie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death is a new book by Katie Butler. Katie joins us by phone. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Pamela. Wonderful to be here.
Now, this is obviously a very grim topic. What led you to write about this?
Well, first of all, I don't think it is a grim topic. I think we've become way too scared to contemplate our deaths, and we all are going to die, and people have been dying for millennia quite successfully. So I think it's not quite as, it doesn't have to be as grim as we think of it. I came to write the book because I shepherded my parents through their declines and then their deaths, which was an eight-year process altogether.
When did they die, and what did they die of?
My father had a major stroke at the age of 79 and had a very, very long decline and died in 2008 at the age of 85. My mother, on the other hand, refused open-heart surgery very close to the end of her life. And about a year and a half after my father died, she died a very swift and merciful death.
And I imagine the contrast between those two deaths is something you address in the book.
Exactly. I feel both of those deaths were lessons to me and taught me a great deal that I didn't know. And my father's really long decline taught me how much I loved him and gave me an opportunity to really express that love. It taught me how fragmented and broken the American medical system is now, especially as it deals with people who are in their final declines. My mother's death, on the other hand, was very, very swift because she really chose to meet it head on. And in a way, I felt it was my father's death, in a way, was too late and my mother's came too soon. But she taught me that you can face your death with realism and courage and clean up the ends of your life and really die quite prepared. And I think her death really continues to be some form of teaching for me that I really can't even fully express or understand.
Did she herself draw a lesson from the way the final years of your father?
Absolutely. After my father's stroke, she became his full-time caregiver and basically had to abandon any life of her own. And it was incredibly stressful, especially as he developed dementia and started to go blind. She saw very clearly that if she was not proactive and almost, I guess, assertive in relation to the medical system, she too could head down the same kind of path that he did, which is the over-prolonging of the very stub end of life. And so she chose another path, I think, probably partly out of kindness to her children, that she didn't want to put us through what she had gone through with my father, but also because she was a very vital, vigorous, and independent person, and she would not have done well with years of being looked after by her daughter or by anybody else. So I think she saw that if she was not courageous and willing to face her death too soon, she might very well die too late. That would cause both her and her family more suffering than she wanted us to suffer.
What does it mean, given our current healthcare system and the way in which we think about death, to die too late?
It's sad to say, but I think my own father died too late. He said, "I'm living too long." He had a major stroke. A year later, he was given a pacemaker with absolutely no forethought and not even really a good medical reason for it. And the device, I believe, prolonged his dying process by at least a couple of years. It's almost a taboo to say this in American culture now, that there could be such a thing as dying too late. But at the same time, there are 24 million people taking care of elderly parents. And a lot of us are watching these parents descend into various forms of misery, including a lot of dementia and helplessness. And people are quietly saying to each other, what are we doing this for? Who is really being served by this pursuit of maximum longevity?
One of the things, my own father died in February, and one of the things that struck me is that the timing for death is almost never right. You know, you think if it's too fast, then, you know, there's no time for goodbyes. If it's yes. prolonged, then it's just, you know, it can just be catastrophic for everyone. And there's never really any good in between. But you do come up with some suggestions as to how this could be done better.
Yes, I think there's a bias in the American medical system right now that favors fixing over care. So we reimburse doctors very well for high-tech fixes like open-heart surgery, even when open-heart surgery is totally inappropriate, whereas we give almost no help for things like home health aides. Primary care doctors make about a third of specialists, and those are the people who really, really know their patients, know their values, and know what is really, really suitable for them. So I think we're contending with this enormous reimbursement bias.
And it also seems that there's some terrible, you know, paradoxes in the way that the healthcare system and insurance and Medicare are set up. You say that if your father had received a diagnosis of a terminal illness, then your family would have been supported by Medicare and by hospice. And that, you know, there's almost these incentives. For example, with my own father, he had a diagnosis of cancer, but if he got chemotherapy, even though it was terminal, he would not be able to be reimbursed for hospice.
Exactly. And I think it's really important for readers to know that there is this growing specialty called palliative care, which is like hospice without the hard edges. It's not dedicated only to people who are in their last 6 months of life. And so it's very important for people to know that they can ask, if they're in the hospital, ask for a palliative care consultation. Palliative care is like hospice without the insane restrictions. And if you can get into a hospice program, you can get a lot more help for the family and for the person.
Tell us about the interrelation of the profit-making side here and the way in which we handle death.
I think things grew like topsy in the 1960s. Prior to the 1900s, people died randomly throughout the lifespan, and so people considered it their spiritual obligation to be emotionally prepared for the deathbed at any time. So they had a very different approach to death to begin with. They were much more accepting of it. Then in the 1960s, we had an amazing panoply of innovation. Dialysis, transplants, the respirator, lots and lots of devices that were brilliant for getting people over a temporary crisis. They were known as bridge technologies. But over time, these bridge technologies became extremely profitable, and so the market for them expanded. And enormous sales forces fanned out across the country to make sure this happened. So the market expanded, and the devices are now used not just for people who need to get over a temporary crisis. They become chronic treatments to try to forestall death and to really kind of, there's stopgaps that can't cure the problem, but they can keep people in these terrible nether states where they're really neither living nor dying.
You write in the book rather poignantly about how this sort of ends the goodbyes in the last words.
In the old days, what was really important was dying at home, being able to give your blessing to your children and your relatives, to reconcile and express your regrets for whatever you regretted in your life, to make your peace with your life, and to make your peace with your God. And when these life-saving devices and inventions became so powerful, so profitable, and so exciting, death was moved into the hospital, and the family was often restricted to visiting hours. And often there were no last words, because people who are using tubes, of like respirator tubes, they have to be either tied down or drugged usually in order to prevent them from tearing out their tubes. So the result is people die unconsciously. They die surrounded by medical equipment, and they're in the hands of strangers who barely know their names. This is a robbing of our spiritual traditions that we are still barely aware of. And I think a lot of people stagger out of an intensive care death traumatized in ways that they just don't know what hit them.
Do you feel like you got to say goodbye to your own mother and father?
With my father, it was very clear because the decline was so long, and we had a very lovely goodbye the morning that I left, about 3 weeks before he actually died. In my mother's case, it was over the phone. We had a very intense, realistic conversation where I told her I thought we were grasping at straws because doctors were again trying to push her to do open-heart surgery when she was a month from her death. She told me it's hard to give up hope, and then we hung up, and she called me back about 20 minutes later to say, "Now, Katie, I want you to give my sewing machine to a woman who really sews. It's a Bernina. It's all metal. It has no plastic parts." And she had moved quite rapidly from clinging to those last straws to being willing to face her death. And so she made peace with my one of my brothers, whom she'd been estranged. And she said some beautiful things to me that I will treasure for the rest of my life. I think death is one of the illustrations of a great teaching, which is that everything changes, and that the more we can accept the changes, the less likely we are to suffer unnecessarily. There's always going to be suffering and loss, but at least these layers of unnecessary suffering that are occurring in American death now really don't have to occur, and we can change it.
All right. Well, we will end on that hopeful, positive note. This is obviously an issue that affects everyone. Katie Butler is the author of Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This is wonderful.
Readers will notice a redesign of the book review in print this week, and with that redesign, some new features, one of which is called Bookends, and Jen McDonald joins us to talk a little bit about that new feature. So Bookends is on the back page where our essays used to run, and we will continue to run essays on occasion elsewhere in the book review, but tell us, Jen, a little bit about the idea behind Bookends and what makes this different and new.
Sure, Pamela. Thanks for having me. The idea, which, you know, credit where credit's due, was your brilliant idea. I have been recruited just to execute it, is to expand the conversation about literature. You know, on Twitter these days, so much chatter happens in 140 characters or less. And we thought we could devote some space to a couple of writers each week who could help broaden the discussion, talk about a lot of different questions that come up in the world of literature and allow them to tackle those at slightly more length, greater length, and a bit more thoughtfully.
And, I mean, a lot of this is really reflecting the kind of conversations that not only occur on Twitter, but occur over dinner and could occur between friends and at book clubs, things that we all talk about and wanted to look at from, you know, not just one perspective, but to have really a wide range of voices kind of offer a take. And so a big part of this was finding the right columnists, people with a strong voice and who aren't afraid to take a position on something, but who could also talk about a broad range of topics.
And we've recruited this really impressive, distinguished group. We have Rivka Galchin, who is a novelist and named one of the New Yorker's 20 under 40 fiction writers in 2010. Mohsen Hamid, who is the author of three novels. Many people will probably know him as the author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which was made into a film.
And Mohsen also does not live in the U.S.
No, he's in Pakistan.
So part of what we wanted with this feature is really to broaden not only the subjects that we look at on our own soil, but really give it a global focus.
Right. We have a pretty international group here. Mohsen, you know, he's a novelist, but he also writes nonfiction and commentary. Rivka has also written narrative journalism for The New Yorker and others. Another of our columnists, Zoe Heller, is an accomplished novelist who a lot of people will know from the book Notes on a Scandal, which was also made into a film. And she also had a career as a columnist and writes criticism for a lot of different publications. Anna Holmes is a founder of Jezebel, the amazing feminist lady news blog that's part of Gawker, right?
Part of the Gawker enterprise.
Adam Kirsch is a senior editor at the New Republic. He's also a poet as well as a very accomplished critic. Daniel Mendelsohn, another accomplished critic who writes across genre. He does criticism. He does translation. He's a trained classicist. Pankaj Mishra is the author of several books and also writes fiction and nonfiction. Francine Prose, another columnist, is the author of at least 20 works of fiction and nonfiction. Is a very accomplished critic as well. Dana Stevens is the film critic at Slate and a co-host of Slate's Culture Gabfest podcast. And our 10th columnist is Jennifer Salai, who was until 2010 a senior editor at Harper's Magazine, where she oversaw the publication's reviews section. Most recently, she did a stint as a preview editor here at the Book Review, filling in for me while I was away for a year.
So we are very glad to have her
back.
Very
glad, yes.
So Jen, explain to listeners how Bookends works.
We have a rotating cast of 10 columnists, and each week we pair two different people together.
Not always the same pairing.
Not always the same pairing. We're going to try to vary it. And we ask them a single question to consider separately. Neither columnist knows who the other person is, so they're really arriving at their argument individually. And then we put them together to see how these two different people arrived at their various points, whether they agree or disagree.
It's kind of the way a lot of us are reading nowadays anyway, where you are maybe reading a book and watching something on TV or sort of multitasking, or reading something online where you have comments and you have reader reviews and you have different people weighing in, so that you kind of have a more open discussion in the way that you approach a subject.
Absolutely. And I don't know about you, I'm sure this is, you work the same way, but when I'm deciding whether to read a book, I don't read just one review. I read several reviews, and maybe they say similar things, but one review will say something really interesting about a book that another doesn't, but it's the combination of them that makes me interested in a book.
I think what stands out about this group, obviously, all of them have written and published widely, is that they really can talk about subjects high, low, in the middle, nonfiction, fiction, books of all different genre, and also about the reading experience and about the way technology is changing the way we read, the way in which the literary conversation is kind of shifting as a result of the internet.
Absolutely. The culture of reading and reading's relationship to popular culture as well. The questions we have coming up in forthcoming issues have a great breadth, and we're going to be addressing some perennial questions sometimes about literature and criticism. Some of our questions will be inspired by recent events and new releases of books.
And to make it clear, this is not a Siskel and Ebert, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, crossfire, he said, she said type of thing, but really trying to get a contrast between two different voices, two different kinds of writers, that even if they come up with the same answer, that they arrive at it from such different ways and write about it in their own voices, that it's interesting to look at the way a question can be answered differently, even when the writers might agree.
Absolutely. It's like eavesdropping on a conversation between two very thoughtful, well-read people.
Bookends, again, edited by the brilliant Jen McDonald. Jen, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Pamela.
The Cancer Chronicles, Unlocking Medicine's Deepest Mystery by George Johnson is reviewed in this week's issue. George joins us by phone from Santa Fe. Hi, George.
Hi, thank you.
So your new book, there have been a number of books recently looking at cancer, and your book looks at it from two perspectives, both from a reported research perspective and also tells a personal story. Can you tell us about these two strands and how you wove them together in the book?
Well, yes. I first became really interested in cancer and then the science of cancer after a very, very sad personal experience. My wife at the time, we're no longer married, had come home from a trip to visit a girlfriend on the West Coast and noticed that she had this suspicious-looking lump on her right leg. And, you know, at the time these things happen, and then your brain just automatically comes up with all of these reasons why it's nothing, because almost everything like that usually turns out to be nothing. But and we'd both been so healthy that, you know, we just assumed, well, obviously this is like some mild infection, or we decided after searching the internet that it was cat scratch fever because one of our cats had recently scratched my wife. You know, so you kind of put it in the back of your mind, but then a series of intervening events kind of delayed getting a biopsy for a few weeks, and then when it came through, you know, there's this moment when you're sitting in a hospital waiting room and someone you really love or care about is in surgery, and then the surgeon comes out smiling with the mask hanging down and saying, "Ah, well, you know, that really went well." So I had that experience a number of times, as I think most of us have, but this time, you know, there was no smile, and, you know, she said, "Well, I think we're looking at a carcinoma." Really the most common kind of cancer, cancer of the epithelial cells, and the problem was they had no idea where the cancer had started in her body, only that it had reached one of the lymphatic nodes, and that was the mysterious bump.
And your wife, Nancy, was ultimately diagnosed with uterine cancer.
Yes, it was a stage 4 metastatic uterine cancer, and, you know, on the general scheme of things, being diagnosed with uterine cancer, particularly in an early stage, is not a terribly bad thing. It has a good survival rate, but after the surgery, and they did, you know, more detailed pathology at the laboratory on the tissues that they removed, they realized that it was something called uterine papillary serous carcinoma, which constitutes just a tiny, tiny percent of uterine cancers, and it's far more aggressive, and it's very similar to ovarian cancer. So, so as a result, that led to a very aggressive treatment. And, you know, my wife is young. She was 43, so they figured this is a very aggressive cancer, and she's a very young, healthy, strong woman, so she can tolerate, you know, a very difficult regime of chemotherapy and followed by radiation.
So you write about this experience, but you also, I mean, your book is also a scientific investigation into...
I mean, the motivation was Nancy's cancer, and at the time, of course, we both were reading everything we could about cancer. And as the science writer who'd written, you know, several books about different aspects of science, none of them really about medical science, you know, I just kind of, you know, it was just natural for me to start accumulating information and thinking about it and analyzing it. And early on, I read this article that Robert Weinberg, a cancer researcher at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, had written describing cancer and how it's a series of mutations to a single cell. And you'll have a single cell kind of sitting there minding its own business. And for one reason or another, you know, it could be a carcinogen in the atmosphere, or it could just be a random mistake. The cell will develop a mutation. You know, one of its genes, you know, will become damaged. And then it will give rise to two daughter cells, you know, who each have that damaged gene. And then, you know, and they'll give rise to two more. And somewhere down the line, another one might get a certain kind of mutation, and then another and another. And if you get six or so, the number varies, of the right kind of mutations, you know, it's very rare, like rolling, you know, six dice, then you might get a cell that becomes carcinogenic. It becomes malignant. It divides rapidly, more rapidly than its neighbors, and it's developed through the mutations the ability to fight back against the various defenses the body has against cancer. So what struck me at some point early on was the very creepy realization that this is like a creature, almost a quasi-creature, that's evolving within the ecosystem of your body. And what we think of is dangerous, harmful mutations from the perspective of the tumor, you know, the clump of cancer cells. These are adaptations, and it's becoming fitter and fitter. But fitness for the tumor means that it's thriving at the expense of the rest of the body.
And you also quote Weinberg with this idea, and I'm paraphrasing, that if we lived long enough, that we would all eventually get cancer.
It's just natural. There's a number that he came up with, back-of-the-envelope calculation, that in any 1 second, 4 million of the cells in our body are dividing. And we have trillions of cells in our body, so that's a tiny subset. But, you know, and then the next second, it might be a different 4 million cells that are dividing. And each time they divide, they have to copy the entire library of genetic information, the genome, to bequeath to the two daughter cells. You know, there's naturally going to be mistakes. We live in an imperfect world that's ruled by entropy. All things complex tend eventually toward decay and disorder. So there will be random mutations, inevitably. Most of these will either be harmless, or they'll kill the cell outright, or the cell, which has safeguards to, you know, kind of scan the genome and look for these things, will react and either repair the damage or take the cell offline. But again, that's an imperfect process as well. So at some point, you're naturally going to accumulate mutations.
So much of what most Americans, most people think about when we look at these numbers is, you know, how do we game it? What are the risk factors? How can I lower it? What do I need less of? What do I need more of? What study is showing that, you know, if you eat X food, you'll be 30% less likely to?
So many of the things that I had thought really helped or possibly really hurt turned out not to be so well established or turned out to be false. So I was just in for a lot of surprises when I really started reading. My wife and I had both assumed that it's really important to eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, for example. There were studies at the time, epidemiological studies, that seemed to indicate that a diet that was very, very heavy with regular doses of fruits and vegetables along with other foods could significantly lower your cancer rate, your risk of getting cancer. And then about 10 years later, as they did more epidemiology and the studies improved and the results were more rigorous, you know, they were taken aback or even shocked to learn that that really didn't seem to hold up. There was only the slightest evidence that eating a lot of fruit and vegetables really had more than a tiny, tiny beneficial effect.
We're also always looking for the bad guys. You know, we know about tobacco, but there's the fear about the cell phones. And you tell this incredible story about radiation with the case of Tsutomu Yamaguchi.
The man who was on a business trip to, the branch office in Hiroshima, you know, arriving just before the United States dropped the atomic bomb. And he was far enough from ground zero that he was able to escape unharmed, or not unharmed, he was able to escape alive, but, he was, you know, very much affected by the blast of light and sound, but not mortally wounded by any means. And then he went back home, you know, after the shock, and he went back home to Nagasaki. So, yeah, just in time, and was exposed to intense radiation from the Nagasaki bomb. And you know, the end of the story is that, he lived to about 90, and he died, and he did die of stomach cancer, and yet there's no way to really say that the radiation back when he was a young man had caused, him to die of cancer. It might have been related to something entirely different.
When you were researching all this, was this during the time that your wife Nancy was being treated for uterine cancer?
It's when I started reading about it, but not as intensely, because there's also a part of you that just doesn't want to know. I was finishing two books at the time that had nothing to do with cancer. One was called Miss Leavitt's Stars, about the woman Henrietta Leavitt, who learned how to measure the universe. She figured out the means we now use for gauging huge stellar distances, and she actually died of stomach cancer early in the 20th century. So my mind was elsewhere, and then after I finished that book and one after that about the 10 most beautiful experiments, I really found myself turning full time to researching cancer and going to cancer meetings and interviewing scientists. And by that time, my wife had thankfully passed the 5-year mark, and this fall she'll pass her 10-year mark. So it turned out that she was indeed one of the outliers and a success story.
All right. Well, we'll end on that note that shows that, you know, perhaps all the numbers aren't quite as definitive as we might think. The book is The Cancer Chronicles, Unlocking Medicine's Deepest Mystery by George Johnson. George, thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Greg Coles joins us with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
So what's new on the list this week?
I wanted to look at the combined lists this week, partly because the fiction list has so many new titles on it, starting right at the top with Robin Carr's romance, The Hero. The combined list, of course, is made up of print and both hardcover and paperback, as well as ebooks. And recently, Bowker released a study of who is migrating most over to ebooks. And the biggest category by far was romance. One out of every four romance titles now is sold as an ebook. And so you really see that reflected here on the combined fiction list.
So it's romance, then spy and thriller, and then science fiction, right?
What's interesting about that is that you do see thrillers here, but not so much of the science fiction turning up on the bestseller combined list. It is still there in hardcover and in mass market paperback. But on the combined list, what we're looking at this week is almost all romance, some suspense, and some crime. So at number one, it's Robin Carr's romance, The Hero. Then at number three, a new crime book by Louise Penny, part of her Armand Gamache series set in Canada. It's called How the Light Gets In. That's new at number three. At number five, another mystery. Kathy Reichs has a book called Bones of the Lost. It is part of her Temperance Brennan series, which is the basis for the Fox show Bones. The interesting thing about Reichs is that she herself is a practicing forensic anthropologist, and she's based her Temperance Brennan character very much on herself and on actual cases that she's handled throughout the course of her long and interesting career.
Forensic anthropologist slash novelist.
Yeah, it's interesting because not a lot of crime writers have actually lived the lives that they're writing about. Patricia Cornwell is not, in fact, a medical examiner, as her character Kay Scarpetta is. Then at number six, a futuristic paranormal romance called Deception Cove by Jane Castle, who you may know better as Jane Ann Krentz. Jane Castle is, in fact, her real birth name and one of the three pen names that she takes while she's writing. At number seven, another romance, Big Sky Wedding by Linda Lale Miller.
Anything else?
Yeah. At number nine, Diane Mott Davidson has a crime novel called The Whole Enchilada. This is part of her series of Goldie Schultz mysteries. Goldie Schultz is a caterer, and this book is part of a kind of an unusual genre you might think of as culinary mystery. It's like the writer Joanna Fluke. These are crime novels that also include recipes as part of it. So they're kind of combination mysteries and cookbooks. And then the last two new titles on the combined fiction list are actually not new titles. They're just new to the list. And they're both by the romance writer and thriller writer Sandra Brown. These are both thrillers. At number 12, a 2001 book called Envy, and at number 13, a 1996 book called Exclusive. This is part of that thing where they're both Kindle Daily deals. Brown has a new book coming out, a new thriller coming out later this month called Deadline. And so I imagine that her publisher made some deal with Amazon to put her backlist on sale. And it just shows, again, this thing where ebooks give publishers a way to really manage their backlists and get these books back.
And generate excitement for the new book coming out.
Exactly so, but by putting them on sale. Something they weren't able to do so easily when you're just talking about print copies of books.
So nonfiction, not as much new.
In fact, there's only one new book on the nonfiction side of things. And again, it's not really a new book. It was first published in 2006. It is Abigail Thomas's really poignant memoir, A Three-Dog Life. This is she had written a memoir earlier about her second marriage and the death of her second husband. After that book already came out, she remarried, and her third husband ended up being hit by a car in a hit-and-run accident, and he suffered real brain damage and had no real concept of the past or the future. He just lived in the present. He was institutionalized. She stayed married to him and visited him, and he spoke in these kind of poetic epigraphs that really kind of taught her to live in the future also. But
live in the present.
I'm sorry, yes.
I would like to live in the future.
Jane Castle lives in the future in that series of books. She crafted a new life for herself, moving out to a small country town and living just with three dogs at the center of her life. And that's it for the combined nonfiction list. There is also a new title on the hardcover nonfiction list that's truly a new title. It's called The Reason I Jump, new at number 11 by Naoki Higashida. He is a 13-year-old boy. He has autism, and he addresses what it's like for him living with autism. This is a book that David Mitchell, the literary novelist who lived in Japan for a time and is closely connected with Japanese culture and literature. He has been a really big advocate of this book.
And he did the translation.
Yeah, in fact, that's right. And it's so it's brought a lot of attention to this book. A really interesting look at what it's like living with autism. And from the perspective of a 13-year-old boy, that's something that you don't usually see.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.